Association has long determined on its own which reporters would participate in the daily poll. For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAIFM. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. Today we have an interview with Electronic Intifada conducted with their guest Ilan Pape, who's coming up with about to release in a few months a new book. Many of you who listen to this program have probably read The Ethnic Cleansing of the Palestinian People, which I think is one of the most accessible and most comprehensive and succinct at the same time books about the Nakba and the occupation of Palestine. But before I do that, I just wanted to relay a few important news items. First of all, we have, I was happy to see that Maersk in Copenhagen, which is responsible for shipping weapons to Israel during the 15 months of genocide, was shut down by activists in Copenhagen yesterday, and it included luminaries like Greta Thunberg, who is consistent, who knows that war is part of global warming, that war is a climate change issue, that all environmentalists should be dealing with this biggest expeller of toxicity into our atmosphere and on the ground, of course, which is being ignored. I would urge you to check out the website Costs of War if you want to see what's the real cost environmentally of these wars, and especially the most recent war where Biden supplied all the ammunition, and now we have Trump. Of course, we have the symbiotic relationship between the two parties. So one destroys Gaza and the other one says, I'm going to buy it and own it, and I'm going to do what he calls Trump Gaza, you know, a play on word, Trump Plaza, that he's going to build a Riviera on the Mediterranean there. But my favorite thing about that story is that they had used an AI platform to basically put together a video showing Trump dancing with belly dancers and Elon Musk eating hummus in Gaza, and both Netanyahu and Trump laying out on the beach, sunbathing like great white whales. Macklemore, God bless him, who's been defiant as ever and consistent as ever with his advocacy for Palestine, with his solidarity, actually took that AI generated video, which is so preposterous as everything that this administration is doing, and I do agree that this administration is its own biggest enemy, even more than the grassroots efforts on the ground right now. It's a train wreck, unquestionably, and we're hearing the news about how things are falling apart, including Dodge employees quitting and such. Macklemore did put his own spin on it, and I can't even play that song because it's full of obscenities, and rightly so. obscenities at the biggest obscenity, which is genocide and occupation and stealing of lands, and the kind of narcissistic bravado that these people are showing. But he put his own song, his own soundtrack to that, and I would urge you to check it out. The other thing, of course, we had a historic event on Sunday with Nasrallah's funeral. As you know, Hassan Nasrallah is the leader of Hezbollah, and his funeral was attended by over 1 million, and the estimates range between 1,200,000 and 1,400,000 people showed up. And this is in defiance not only of Israel, but also in defiance of the own Lebanese government, which has done nothing to force Israel or confront Israel about the fact that they've broke the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon over 100 times, as reported by CNN. For some of you who saw the scenes of that mass gathering from where people came from all over the world, east and west, to celebrate this liberator that is considered a terrorist by some nations, just like Mandela was considered a terrorist by many nations. Even when Israel tried to scare the attendees by flying planes over, the response was immediate, which is raised fists and cries for the destruction of Israel. So that's the kind of fearless defiance to expect in the coming months, when the ceasefire deal is done. And at this point, we do have, after Israel bulldozed several villages, taking advantage of the ceasefire deal, as they always do. Of course, they're the most unprincipled military in the world, so what should we expect other than that? But they've left five posts, they call them strategic posts, in Lebanon that they're occupying. It'll be interesting to see in the coming months what's going to happen with these posts. And lastly, I wanted to report on a local issue. At American University here in Washington, D.C., the Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace students at American University were about to do a teach-in on Zionism. And the administration, and I'm sure this is the work of Alger, this new president that we have, basically shut it down under the pretense of safety. And what's interesting is that it was all about the safety of Zionists, not the safety of Jewish students that put together this teach-in, but for the safety specifically of Zionists, which he doesn't mention Zionists. He claims those are the true Jews. So he claims that the true Jews are the ones that are attaching Judaism to the barbarism of Zionism, not the real Jews who are calling for peace. But anyway, he shut this thing down, and ironically, he shut it down because these people are just crass careerists. He shut it down because it's on the day that there was a hearing in Illinois, or the trial in Illinois of the landlord that stabbed the 6-year-old Palestinian kid in Illinois 26 times and killed him and even wounded his mother. His mother was stepping up to the podium when this president released the statement about the safety of Zionists, not the safety of Palestinian students who have been subjected to all kinds of violence, not just from the police, but as in the murder of these students in northeast of the United States, where one was crippled, and or the fact that there are people gunning for Palestinians in the streets, as we happened to see last week in Florida, where this Zionist shot 17 times at a car that had two people in it thinking they're Palestinian, and ironically they turned out to be Israeli. And since the Israelis were wounded in that shooting didn't know that the guy that shot them was actually a Zionist, that they basically put out a statement that ended it with death to Arabs. So this is the kind of madness that's happening in the world. Always we find refuge in the sanity of, like in the clip that we're about to hear. This is an interview with Ali Abu Nima, that Ali Abu Nima and Noura Burrows Friedman had conducted with Ilan Pappe about this is vision for the future and why he believes there is that Israel will basically is on a timer right now where Israel would end before the 100-year anniversary of the Nakba. So let's have a listen to this very informative interview.
Now to welcome someone back to the live stream who we last spoke to almost a year ago, which is incredible to me. Ilan Pappe is Professor of History at the University of Exeter in the UK and Director of the European Centre for Palestine Studies. He gained renown as one of the New Historians, a group of Israeli scholars who in the 1980s shattered long-standing Zionist lies about the founding of Israel and corroborated Palestinian accounts of the Nakba using Israeli archival sources. He's the author of many, many books, more than I can keep up with. And there's a new one coming up that we'll talk about in a bit. But he's the author of A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan is also a regular contributor to the Electronic Intifada. He is a distinguished scholar and has been a longtime advocate and voice for the liberation of Palestine. Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream, Ilan.
Thank you, Ali and Nora and Essa. It's so good to be again in the show. Thank you for reinviting me.
Thank you,
It's always good to have you.
and we know you've been traveling too, and you have a tough schedule, so we're incredibly grateful that you were able to make time for us. Ilan, let's get right into it then. It's been 1 month since the ceasefire took effect in Gaza, and we've now witnessed six prisoner exchanges in which Israelis have returned from Gaza and Palestinians have been released from Israel's prisons and torture chambers. Talk about how these scenes are being viewed in Israel.
Yes. Well, we have to stress and remember that most of the Israelis, not all of them, but most of the Israeli Jews get their information only from one source, the three or four official TV channels, which are very selective in the way that they cover these exchanges or the whole issue of the ceasefire. And that, of course, impacts the way the Israelis understand what they are seeing. So, for example, there is no at all coverage of what goes on the Palestinian side. How do the prisoners released look like? What they have experienced? How they are welcomed? It's if is only there's only one side to this exchange, and the commentary is very biased, of course. So I would say that on the one hand, of course, families which are directly connected to people who were released in this prisoners exchange deal are delighted and, of course, feel a great relief, as do probably a lot of the people who support them. But on the other hand, there is still a very strong sense, and that's a bizarre situation, and I'm sure you are familiar with it by now. Almost even I would say almost any respectable journalist, let's put it this way, in Israel, respectable for the Israelis, not necessarily for me, claim that Netanyahu is still doing his best to fail the deal. And that this is still a huge problem, and there's a lot of pessimism about what is called the second phase of the exchange. Why do I say it's a bizarre situation? Because unfortunately, this lack of confidence in Netanyahu's genuine will to see the prisoner exchange come to fruition, there's no change in the attitude towards the genocide in Gaza, or to the fact that Israel says very loudly and clearly that once the prisoner exchange deal will end, it will try and go back to war if it doesn't get the vision of Gaza that it wishes for. So I would say it's kind of a very emotional part for people who were directly involved either in the exchange because they are their relatives or because they were part of the movement that demanded the exchange. And yet this whole skepticism about whether it will be completed and whether this really means the end of the war. I think that sort of sums up what you can gather from the mood of the society and the main media of that society.
I mean, following up on that, for most of the last 16 months, opinion polls showed that the Israeli Jewish public strongly supported continuing the genocide in Gaza, as well as some of its top lawmakers and members of Knesset. But in recent months, the mood seems to have shifted. Early this month, the Israeli Democracy Institute published a poll which found that 66% of Israeli Jews agreed that, quote, Israel should proceed to the second stage, which includes a complete end to fighting, withdrawal from Gaza, and the release of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the release of all the hostages. And another poll published by the Lazar Institute at the end of January found that only 4% of Israelis believe that the goals of the war in Gaza were met. Talk a little bit more about how you see the national mood in Israel right now.
Definitely. I think that these polls are authentic and reflect a certain trauma, even, I would say, with regard to what happened on the 7th of October and after the 7th of October. So on the one hand, Netanyahu is losing in all the popularity polls. He's in a very bad position compared where he was a few months ago. And there is a wish to see the prisoner deal completed. I'm not so sure that the polls represent correctly the mood about what would happen after that. Because I think Ali, I always quote Ali on this, but Ali, do forgive me if I'm misquoting you here, but I think you once said that the Israelis believe that Hebrew is a secret language that nobody understands. And I think that that's very important to listen to what politicians and journalists say in Hebrew, not in English, in the Israeli media. And what is for me very worrying is that the main message is, including those who fully support the end, the completion of the prisoner exchange deal, is that we can do it now and we can always go back to the war and Hamas will give us enough excuses or pretexts to continue the bombing. I would be very worried from describing these polls as a systematic or kind of a fundamental change in the ways Israelis perceive either the Palestine issue or peace and so on. I think we should not be misled by this. This is still a nation that, or a group of a society that still believes that it can solve its predicaments by force, by dispossession, by ethnic cleansing, by genocide. You won't hear any voice in Israel opposing the fact that already 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced from their homes in the West Bank. And therefore, I think from the outside, we should be careful with that. This is very important. They do want to see, of course, they want to see all the prisoners back home. That's natural. There's no doubt about that. And they don't like Netanyahu, undoubtedly. But from there to conclude that because of that, you know, they would like to see an end of violence or a different approach to how to deal with the issue. It's the issue in essence. I would be very careful. I think Israel is still a society that won't change from within, and the only way of bringing freedom, liberation, and decolonization is by pressure from the outside and continue the struggle. It won't happen from within.
That point's well taken, Ilan, but let me push you a little bit more on it, because Netanyahu says he wants to go back to the war. Even in his press conference with Donald Trump in Washington, he was careful to allow himself room for that. Donald Trump gave him a perfect opportunity when he said that if Hamas doesn't release all the remaining captives by last Saturday at noon, then all hell will break loose. If Netanyahu wanted to take that as an opportunity to resume the war, that was a perfect opportunity. Here was the U.S. president telling him, you know, go ahead, I'll back you. And yet he didn't do it. My question then is not so much, or at least you've made clear what the desires of Israelis are. They still want to wipe the Palestinians off the map, so to speak. But talk about the capability.
Okay.
The fact that Netanyahu didn't rush back to war when Trump gave him an opportunity. What can you tell us about the state of Israeli society in a material sense, the state of the army, the state of the economy, the morale of the people to resume a war at any time? What can you read into the situation?
First of all, I don't think Netanyahu can go back to war before the prisoner exchange is completed. And therefore, he could not use Trump's idea of all hell should break out if not all the prisoners are released. And that was Saturday a week ago. He couldn't do it. I mean, that would mean publicly admitting that he gave up on the prisoners, and that he wouldn't do. I don't think he would do this. So he tries to navigate with his allies in the government by saying, okay, we are continuing with this deal. But remember, we will go back to war once it's completed. That's the message. And therefore, it's a different message from the Trump message. And then Trump himself, as if you might remember, probably by advice of someone close to him, said, I didn't mean all the prisoners. I just meant those that were supposed to be released in the sixth phase or something like that. But far more important is the second part of your question. And I come back to a point that I think we also discussed in our last meeting almost a year ago. The Jewish society in Israel is deeply divided between two sections. And we have to understand that they have different perception of the reality. And the balance of power between these two sections in many ways would impact Israeli policies in the future. You have on the one hand what I called recently the state of Judea. This is the part of the Jewish society that grew up in the Jewish settlements in the West Bank, used to be quite marginal in Israeli politics, but since November 2022 became a force to reckon with, not only in government, not only do they hold very important ministerial positions, but they have overtaken the police, they've overtaken the Secret Service, or they are in the process of overtaking the Secret Service, the army. The one institution they haven't yet been able to take over is the judicial institution, but they're not far from that objective. Now, the perception of these people is that they are in the midst of a window of opportunity to recreate the biblical Israel, maybe even extend it beyond historical Palestine to West Syria and South Lebanon. And they're even waiting for a big war with Iran. Now, of course, they don't have the capabilities to do this. I don't think that they have the capabilities to do this. But they are the ones, I think, that would determine in many ways the Israeli policies. The other group, you can call it the old state of Israel, if you want, is being swallowed by the state of Judea. And the election of Trump and the rise of neo-fascist right-wing parties in the global community West and the continued government like Modi in India, all of this gives it more a kind of a breath of life to continue to be a dominant power in Israeli politics, that is the state of Judea that swallows the state of Israel. The state of Israel, if I can call it that way, that would like to see the Jewish society build more on liberal democratic values is still one that believes in apartheid Israel. I mean, we have here two versions of apartheid Israel. The difference between them is, first of all, of how they view the Jewish life in Israel, but there's also another difference, and the difference of competence, which is important to understand. And it comes back to your questions of capabilities. The people who are now taking over all the positions of power in Israel, if you want, all the junctures of power, whether it's the army, the economy, or politics, come from the more neo-Zionist right-wing Jewish society, which I framed as a state of Judea. They are not very capable in running anything, not very competent, but they are on the march because of Donald Trump and other international developments, but not for long, to my mind, not for long, and they are not capable of doing it. So therefore, we will have a policy that would not be implemented, but while it would be attempted to be implemented, it can still cause quite a lot of misery, carnage, and violence. And I think that's where we are. We are in this very important juncture where I don't think we have any of us have the power to stop it immediately, but we have to be encouraged by the fact that it is self-destructive. It is self-destructive. And it depends on very negative forces on in the region and in internationally. And therefore, I think it's the end of a period and not the beginning of a period, but it's a very dangerous and precarious moment in the history of modern Palestine. So in terms of capabilities, they don't have the power to implement the full vision, but in their attempt to do this, there are ethnically cleansing people in the West Bank. They will go back to violence in Gaza. They will try to keep West Syria and South Lebanon under their control. So much depends on how people would react to this, how they react locally, regionally, and internationally. And the more effective the reaction, the shorter the damage, the period of damage that they are inflicting will be.
And I mean, last time you were on, and you've been saying this for years, you know, that this is accelerating the collapse of Zionism, and also, you know, you just, as you mentioned, that Israeli society is beginning to kind of eat itself. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and how that is revealing itself now, you know, 16 months after the beginning of this genocide, what the state of Zionism is and how you are seeing it continuing to collapse, and kind of what comes next, you know, not to speculate or, you know, look into a crystal ball, but as someone who's studied this for so long and knows intimately, you know, how Zionism reacts and how it how Zionism as an ideology is the self-perpetuating cycle of violence in itself. What comes next? What do you think is on the horizon?
Well, I think that we are seeing discrete processes, independent processes, if you want, that have not fused yet together to that moment in history where you can say there is a transformation, there is a transition. But I do think the question is not, will these processes infuse into that dramatic moment of change? The question for me is not if, but when and how. And I don't know the when, and I don't know exactly the how, but I'm very sure that there's no question of if. In fact, since we last talked, I think the processes I identified have only intensified. Let me mention some of them. One is the implosion from the social implosion from within that led to mass immigration of Israeli Jews from what I would call the old state of Israel. I mean, the people who might have offered an alternative to the neo-Zionist messianic ideology that has taken over Israel since November 2022, many of them decide not even to try and confront it, and leaving the country in huge numbers. We don't have the full statistics, but we suspect that the number is really huge and significant also, given who the people are. The second process is the erosion in the power of the army. I mean, we keep forgetting that the greatest military success of Israel are against two, if at all these are military successes, are against two guerrilla movements. They don't have aeroplanes. They don't have tanks. They don't have the kind of support that the United States provides Israel with endless ammunition and cutting edge weaponry. And yet, even there, the success is not complete. If you look at the Jenin camp in the West Bank, Israel needs thousands of soldiers, hundreds of armored vehicles, F-16 and F-35s to defeat a small group of youngsters with very primitive weapons. So I think even the Israelis themselves understand that there's something about the invincibility of the army that is very questionable. Should at any given moment something change in the neighboring Arab states, for instance, this whole sense of we don't have to worry because we have the army that would make sure that nothing would happen was already shattered on the 7th of October, but has not been rectified since. Economically, the economic crisis only deepens. And relatively, it's this year in particular is the only year compared to all the other years that the Israeli reliance on American financial aid has risen to a portion that is unprecedented in the history of Israel. I mean, dependence on American financial aid has never been as it is now. And that raises a lot of questions, even about the Trump administration and its all ideas of more isolationist and so on. So that's another process to look at. There is the disassociation of the Jewish communities in the world from Israel. Israel is left more and more with Christian fundamentalists as its main supporters and neo-right fascist parties in Europe. The Palestinian continued, especially the younger Palestinian generation, showing more unity, of course, than Palestinian politics itself, and a clear vision in the future. The beginning of courageous actions by countries like Colombia in the global south. I mean, if you take all these things together, you can see that we are coming to this moment of truth where a project, which was a European project, to solve the European problem of racism and anti-Semitism by forcing a Jewish state on the Arab world, on the Muslim world, is not working with all the force that had to be invested to make it, to establish it and to sustain it and to keep it intact in the future. So I think these processes are accelerated now, actually. There is an optical, with this, I'm sorry, it takes me a bit long to say this, but I think it's important. There's a bit of an optical illusion. The election of Trump, the coming elections in countries like Belgium, the Netherlands, Austria, Germany, and even, unfortunately, Norway in 2026, which might bring back the right wing and also the extreme right wing to power, creates the illusion as if Israel has nothing to worry from the global community. But I think this is an optical illusion because these are very tactical changes in terms of long-term historical processes that would not be there forever. And they may slow down some of the processes I'm talking about, but they're not going to stop them.
And last time we talked to you, we talked about your book, Lobbying for Zionism. And So you've thought a lot about the Israel lobby. Thinking about, you're talking about right-wing parties that support Israel, and often they're anti-Semitic right-wing parties when we're talking about Europe. But also we continue to see supposedly left-wing governments or center-left governments like the Labour Party government in the UK, you could name others, that continue to provide unconditional support for Israel that's increasingly out of step with popular opinion. How do you explain that? Is it just the power of the lobby? Is it their fear of the United States? Right now we see the Trump administration, in a sense, breaking up with Europe. We saw the speech of J.D. Vance, the vice president at the Munich Security Conference, in which he signaled that the U.S. is no longer willing to support Europe the way it has in the last 80 years since World War II. How do you explain this continued insistence on supporting a regime whose brutality and violence and genocidal barbarity really can't be concealed in any way now?
Yeah,
and it's an unfair question because it's a lot to try to figure out, but I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's a fair and important question, in fact, and I was thinking about it a lot, actually. I think there are two ways of answering or trying to answer these very important questions. One is that if we want to think positively of the liberation of Palestine, its decolonization, the end of oppression, and so on, I think we have realized by now that the local balance of power is not very conducive for such a change, that you need a change in the regional balance of power and the international balance of power to push forward the liberation, the decolonization, and freedom. And that means that the essence of politics, as it's being kind of implemented in the world, whether it's in the global West, particularly in the global West, but also in the global South, as long as it remains as it is, namely politicians who care more about their own future than the concerns of their own societies, are not willing to collaborate internationally to deal with issues of global nature, such as global warming and so on, as long as this essence of politics remains as it is, Israel is winning, if you want, and the Palestinians are losing. Every little step that challenges successfully these kind of politics, like what we have seen in the second round of elections in France, for instance, is winning for the Palestinians. So there is, first of all, this overall understanding of how politics is being made in so many parts of the world. And right now, the essence of politics is not conducive for representing fully what the societies want, including on Palestine, but not only on Palestine, which is a point of strength for us, I think, because it means we can create a far wider alliance for changing politics that would benefit Palestine, but does not have to focus only on Palestine. The other way of looking at it, if you talk about the Labour Party, the Democratic Party in America, social democratic parties in Western Europe, I think that there is a fear, and this is from my understanding, talking to a lot of people, reading what they write, there's a lot of fear about the complicity of the European left, of the Democratic Party, of the liberal politics, call it what you want, the one that is not extreme right-wing and right-wing, the complicity of that part of politics, including some communist parties, in allowing the colonization of Palestine, in sustaining the colonization of Palestine, in creating the reality that we see today. And they don't want to open this Pandora box. So they would rather go by the inertia. Of course, the lobby is there to make sure that this kind of attitude is being maintained. But I think it is, as I tried to show in my book, Lobbying for Zionism, if you have an effective lobby for more than 100 years, most of your clients, so to speak, work by inertia. You don't even have to pressure them anymore. You know, I was always thinking, and I think we talked about it, of Joe Biden arriving in 74 in the Senate, sitting in the Foreign Affairs Committee and seeing how the lobby destroys Fulbright. And I'm sure this is a lesson that stayed with him. So there was no need for the lobby to pressure Biden as a president. It was also already part of the DNA. So I think that this is, again, the end of a period. That's what I mean by an end of a period. Don't look at the present actors, whether are on the left or on the right, in local politics or regional politics or international politics, as those who would bring a change. We need to look, hopefully, for the beginning of a new epoch, a new period by which politics is based on other principles, more reflective on people's concern. And my big question is all the time, how can we reflect the huge coalition we had in the demonstrations for Palestine in the last year and a half into a powerful movement of politics from above, which I think what we have failed so far to do. Namely, we know exactly that we bridged over different opinions, different ideological positions even, to create a powerful alliance that brought 1 million.
Oh, we're going to try and recollect.
Hopefully we can get him back.
Reconnect with Ilan. He is traveling this week, and so we're very grateful we could have him on. But Nora, what do you think? We're talking about, like, I was talking with a friend yesterday, and I was like, whatever happened to Kamala Harris? I hate to bring that name up, but it's like,
yeah.
Has there been, are you seeing any reflection at all within?
No, of course. What I am seeing is a lot of blame, and a lot of blame primarily on Arab and Muslim Americans, young people, and those of us who refused to vote for the enablers, the architects of a genocide. So there's a lot of blame. There is absolutely no introspection by the Democratic Party, its supporters, or anyone who thought that bringing Liz Cheney on to Kamala Harris's support team and doubling down on support for genocide was a good idea. So it's a very important point. It is.
Yeah, and right now, thinking about
Ilan is back.
Oh, he's back. All right, yeah. Very good. Let's bring him back.
Hi.
I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Anyway, I moved to my phone just to be on the safe side. I did finish my reply in many ways, actually. I just said that I would have liked to see the coalition that created such a huge solidarity transformed into part of a global movement of changing the essence of politics, which I think would benefit Palestine, and not just Palestine, global issues of injustice, yeah, and local issues of injustice.
And while we were reconnecting you, we were just talking about the lack of any reflection within, say, the Democratic Party after their defeat. And the fact that Gaza definitely played a role in it. There were enough people not willing to go out and vote for genocide. And so maybe it's a question for another day, but the question I think many people will struggle with is where this politics will take place. Is it in the streets? Is it in universities where there's increasing repression? Because the traditional political structures, including party politics and electoral politics, don't seem to be capable of delivering that type of change. Indeed, these systems seem to be designed to prevent it and to co-opt and diffuse any movement, as we saw, for example, with Jeremy Corbyn. And even with Bernie Sanders, for all his flaws, he represented enough of a threat to the system, yep, that they had to take extraordinary measures to stop him. So maybe this is straying too far from our topic, but to think about where this new politics will even take place is challenging.
Well, historically, I think what we have to remember that these are long processes of change. And the movement, for example, in Europe, both in the 18th and 19th century, from, if you want, politics of the street, of the center of town, of the piazza, into the politics of parliament, changing a whole feudal system, an authoritarian system, it was a long process. And eventually what happened was that the institutions were began to be populated by people who saw things differently. I think we should not give up on the politics from above, despite everything you said, Ali, and I agree with you. I do think that we are probably have to rethink a little bit about pragmatism, less of a purist position, and maybe even work under this sense of urgency when it comes to Palestine, and shorten the period by which the clear, very exciting and empowering politics from below that we have seen in the case of Palestine are reflected from above. I do agree that this is a huge challenge, but I don't see an alternative way for it. And I do think it is possible. Looking, for example, what happened in Vietnam, what happened in South Africa, what happened in Algeria, and so on. These are not perfect changes of politics, but they are effective enough to cause regimes to change, to disintegrate rogue states, and so on. Not to mention the fact, and I think, again, that's a topic for another conversation, we have to be very careful from disassociating what's happening in Palestine from what's happening at least in the Eastern Mediterranean as a whole, what in Arabic we call the Mashrek. The whole political system that was built after the First World War by the colonialist powers is disintegrating not only in Israel and Palestine, but also in Syria. And also Lebanon and Jordan are in a precarious moment in their history. And that's why I keep thinking that this is the end of that period, not the beginning of something new. And any change in that political structure, in the way politics is being done also in places such as Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon and other places, is also something that would benefit Palestine. Palestine has to be anyway reintegrated politically, culturally, and organically into the Arab world. One of the greatest success, or the attempted success of Zionism, was to disassociate Palestine, to take it out of its cultural and regional context, and only reintegrating it to that region, to Bilad al-Sham and everything that was there before the First World War, would enable us to change also the balance of power. Because if you think about it, if you think about Palestine as being part of a greater region, the Jews are a tiny minority. But if you think about Palestine only in historical Palestine, you think that you are facing a formidable enemy that is not likely to be defeated. But it's a very different perspective if you take the regional approach. So in that respect, it's not just the inability to change institutional attitudes. I really think that this has a lot to do with the essence of politics that could be advocated also through existing institutions and structures. I don't see many alternative to such structures. We cannot go to the Athenian democracy or something like that. But definitely, I mean, by all means, if the situation in Palestine is a trigger also for thinking of a revolutionary way of how to do politics, all for the better. But I even in without such a dramatic revolution in how politics is being represented, I still think that we are in the big at the end of a period and transiting into a period that even these institutions will be far more receptive to the concerns of people in general and the concerns of people on Palestine in particular. And this I'm saying by talking to young politicians in Germany, in Europe, in the Arab world, young Palestinians. I do think this young generation understands that this is part of their future. And even if they detest organizations and structures, they still need them, I think, to translate great visions and ideas into a real politics on the ground.
You have a new book coming out later this year titled Israel on the Brink and the Eight Revolutions That Could Lead to Decolonization and Coexistence. Unfortunately for those of us eager to read it, we're still going to have to wait a few months. But you do talk about what you've been mentioning, your argument that the beginning of the end of the Jewish state began in 2022 with the election of the most right-wing government, or maybe most honest government in the nation's history. Can you give us an overview of your argument and why this book now?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's the main motive was very curious in a way to write it. I was annoyed that when I and others appear in front of audiences and we talk to people and tell them how terrible the situation of the Palestinians are, we receive standing ovations. And I felt very bad about it. I mean, what are you clapping for? I mean, I'm telling you how horrible things are. I'm not expected to be, rewarded for that. I understand why it happened. Of course, I'm not blaming anyone. But it looked to me as if one has to think, is there only a message of a pessimistic message, and is this only our role to share with people how bad the things are, or are we also, especially analysts and people who are kind of so much engaged with it day and night, or do we have also something more positive to offer? And I wanted to offer it not just as an activist, but as an academic. And that was the main drive for the book. And it was not enough, I thought it was not enough to identify the processes of disintegration, and we talked about them. Because disintegration, as we have seen in Syria, can lead to a chaos and void, and not necessarily immediately lead to something better. We have some very dismal chapters of decolonization in several parts in the global south. But then I thought maybe I'm trying to think, and I'm basing myself mainly on reading a lot what young Palestinians in particular talk about what could make sure not only that there is a collapse, because I don't think the collapse only depends on the Palestinians, as I've tried to explain. I think it depends on so many other issues. But how do we make sure that the collapse is turning to something positive? That's the first question. And secondly, will anybody listen to me if I want to talk about it now? People say, come on, Ilan, there's no need. You're hallucinating. What's the point of talking about how to implement the right of return? What's the point of talking? What would be the future of the Jews in a decolonized Palestine? What would happen to the settlements in the West?
I just wanted to end the show by thanking people who donated to the Shayanana and to WPFW FM during the fund drive in the past couple of weeks, because you helped us make our goals, and it's greatly appreciated. And WPFW is more important and more essential and more necessary than ever, because it's one of those mediums that basically goes under the radar and goes right to the truth. And I predict that with all the censorship that's going on, especially in the high-tech social media that's owned by oligarchs, that this independent station is going to become more vital and more important And so your support was essential in helping us be the bullhorn for activists in DC and for those who are fighting on multiple fronts right now, whether it's immigration, whether it's the Palestinian issue, or whether the many varied fronts that have been formed by Elon Musk and the absurdity of this administration. And of course, this is a sign of a declining empire. It may seem like it's an empire on the rise, but it's a decline. We'll see you next Wednesday. Thank you.
Stop the genocide, but I think this is being done.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The Trump administration moved forward today with its plans to conduct large-scale layoffs of federal workers across agencies. The Office of Management and Budget issued a memo to agency leaders with guidance on how to conduct their reductions in force, known as RIFs, and the reorganization plans as per Donald Trump's executive order entitled Implementing the President's Department of Government Efficiency Workforce Optimization Initiative. The first phase includes submitting lists of agency divisions and employees performing functions not mandated by law or regulation who are not considered essential employees during government shutdowns. The memo expands Donald Trump's effort to downsize the federal workforce, which he has described as an impediment to his agenda. Thousands of probationary employees have already been fired, and now his administration is turning its attention to career officials with civil service protection. In more news, the House adopted a sweeping budget blueprint last night by a slim margin of 217 to 215. The GOP plan calls for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts over the next decade, partially offset by at least $2 trillion in spending cuts, and it is a key step that serves as a pathway for implementing President Trump's agenda. Democratic Representative Maxine Waters, speaking on the House floor last night, said, quote, "Democrats are no on this budget. It is outrageous that you all have the audacity to come here with this budget that harms so many Americans and asks us to support billionaires," close quote. The House budget could still increase the federal deficit due to the high cost of extended tax cuts. That was a key point of contention for the handful of Republicans initially reluctant to support the bill. The next step is the reconciliation process, during which both the House and the Senate need to sign off on the same budget containing all the specific spending cuts, tax cuts, and other measures before it goes to Trump for a signature. In more news, a new federal lawsuit is challenging a Trump administration memo giving the nation's schools and universities until February 28 to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs of any kind or risk losing their federal funding. The lawsuit filed yesterday by the American Federation of Teachers Union and the American Sociological Association says the Education Department's February 14 memo violates the First Amendment by forcing schools to teach only the views supported by the federal government. The lawsuit takes issue with a line in the memo condemning teaching about systemic and structural racism. The lawsuit asks a judge to declare the policy unconstitutional and bar federal officials from enforcing the directive. And the Trump administration said yesterday that it would start handpicking which media outlets were allowed to participate in the presidential press pool, which is a rotating group of reporters who report the president's day-to-day activities to the public. It allows the White House to assert more control over which journalists can witness Trump's activities.